We are talking today with Sonia Shaw. She is author of the new book, Crude, The Story of Oil. Sonia, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks, Mike.
If you could start out and tell us, what was the motivation in writing Crude?
Well, it's actually a pretty prosaic story. I'm a journalist, and I was living near the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, where a billion-barrel oil field is suspected to lurk underneath the reef or near the reef. And the Australians are very good about protecting the reef from mineral extractors, but they do allow scientific exploration. So what had happened is there was a number of supposedly scientific expeditions onto the reef where they were actually drilling cores out of the seafloor. And that's, you know, that's a perfectly legitimate academic exercise because they look at the cores and they look at the sedimentary layers and they try to judge, you know, how climate has changed and, you know, different things like that. But on the expeditions where they went near the reef, near where the suspected oil fields were, it wasn't just academics who were on board. It was all these geologists from oil companies like Shell and Exxon, etc. So this was a very interesting story in Australia at the time, and I wrote an article about it. And when I did that, I wrote as background, I had read a book by Ken DeFays, who's a geologist from Princeton, called Hubbert's Peak. And in that, he talks about oil's hydrocarbon molecules, you know, these long, elegant molecules of chains of carbons, you know, linked together, and how beautiful and elegant they are. And he imagines having this conversation with his great-grandchild, and the great-grandchild says, "And Grandpa, you just burnt it?" And he has to say, "Yeah, we just burnt it," you know? You know, that just really intrigued me, the idea of oil as a precious natural resource rather than this stinky thing that you encounter 5 minutes a week when you fill up your tank.
So how did you go about from there to deciding, I'm going to write a book about this?
Well, I got an editor interested. You know, I started talking about it, and he said, "You've got to write that book about oil." You know, I was actually pitching a story for a different book idea at the time. And everyone was talking about oil. I mean, it was right on the cusp of when it looked like we were going to be invading Iraq. And, you know, there was just this vacuum of accessible books that really laid out not just the politics and the history of oil, but what is oil? What do we use it for? How did we get to the point where we are today where we're using oil 100,000 times faster than it could possibly accumulate again? What does this mean for us as a species? So that's what I kind of tried to do in my book.
Maybe give us kind of a history of some of the early uses of oil. I have the impression that the first commercial application was for kerosene.
Yeah, that's right. You know, most industrial society at the time, you know, in the 1800s, was based on coal. Obviously, in Britain was the capital, the coal capital of the world, and that's where the Industrial Revolution had taken place, and where steel and iron and the steam engine and all these things had come together to create this new way of living, industrial society. And in the U.S., there was tons and tons of coal. I mean, there still is tons and tons of coal, but there's also this other stuff, oil. And in 1859, or, you know, right around there, people were kind of noticing this black gunk on top of the creeks in Pennsylvania, and they're just sticking rags in and soaking it in and squeezing it out and using it for medicine, different things like that at the time, because they didn't know what it was. But the first oil well was set up to do commercial extraction of oil in 1859 in Pennsylvania. Within 30 years, you know, it was like a gold rush. So within 30 years, it was gone. All of Pennsylvania oil was gone. And John D. Rockefeller, the entrepreneur, had set up Standard Oil Company, which has become the model of the ruthless, vertically integrated, gigantic mega corporation that we see today, you know, everywhere, and we don't even blink an eye. Back then, it was sort of scandalous the way he conducted himself. I mean, people hated him. But he built his market on, as you said, on the market for kerosene, because crude oil is a mix of various different kinds of hydrocarbon molecules, from octane, which is what we use in our cars, to kerosene, to propane, to butane, to methane, which is natural gas. So there's this mix of all different kinds of hydrocarbons. And at the time, the only one that they used was the kerosene. All the rest was waste. They used it in their lamps. But then, in 1879, Thomas Edison invented the light bulb, and that was pretty much the end of the kerosene market.
So what happened after they developed the light bulb?
Well, for Standard Oil, they had tons and tons of oil. I mean, you have to remember, the United States at one time had more oil than there is in Iraq today. You know, we had 180, maybe more, 190 billion barrels of oil in this country. There's only about 30 billion barrels left. today around. So, you know, the oil was just coming out everywhere. It was a real surplus, and it was very easy to get at. It was just seeping out of, you know, coming out in the creeks, slipping down cliff faces and things. So it didn't require a lot of know-how or technical expertise to find this stuff. And so Rockefeller had tons and tons of oil. They had left Indiana. They had left Pennsylvania. They had gone on to Ohio and Indiana by then. And they needed a market. You know, they needed something to use this stuff for. And lo and behold, within 10 years, the internal combustion engine was developed. And it wasn't popular at all at the time. I mean, people were just making fun of these things. You know, people had trains, they had bicycles. You know, people could walk around back then. You know, I mean, imagine today, you could never use your own energy to finish the transportation you have to do in a single day. You know, you have to burn fossil fuels in some way. It's just inconceivable that you could walk, you know, for everything you do in a day. I mean, for most Americans, that is, anyway. But back then, you could, and so people didn't really need cars. And the other part of it is there was no roads. The carriages and bicycles could go on these rutted roads or on the grass or whatever, but there was no smooth asphalt for cars to go on. It was all rutted, unpassable dirt, mud. So cars were not very popular. I mean, within the first 3 or 4 years of cars being marketed in the U.S., I think they sold about a dozen.
Were the oil companies then aligning themselves with the car manufacturers because they saw that as a good move?
Well, that was exactly it. That was the kind of fateful partnership that has changed the world is between the oil companies and the auto companies. And first probably started in World War I, where Churchill decided to switch his Navy warships from burning coal to burning oil, which was a fateful thing to do because Britain had tons and tons of coal, but they had no oil. So if they're going to fight a war, they're going to fight a war completely based on this fuel that they don't have any access to. But by then, of course, they had found oil in Iran, which was then called Persia. So using internal combustion engines in machines of war during World War I is what started to change people's minds about these machines and start this partnership between oil companies and auto companies. Auto companies made hundreds of trucks during World War I to ferry the soldiers, American soldiers, from across the country to the coast so they could get on a boat and go to the Europe to fight in the war. But the roads were so bad that they ended up having to put the trucks on the trains and then go over to the coast, which is a huge, I mean, you can imagine, a huge embarrassment. I mean, the whole exercise was about showing off these brand new machines and how great they were, and instead they had to put them on the train. So then, you know, over time, between World War I and World War II, of course, people were more interested in street trolleys and things like that, and there's this well-documented example of collusion between General Motors, Firestone, and Standard Oil, among other companies, who sort of banded together to buy out the electric trolley system, and they started to curtail service. They basically dismantled the whole thing and introduced buses instead and hoped people would hate the buses so much because they were stinky and slow that they'd start buying cars instead, you know, with Firestone rubber and using Standard Oil and GM cars. So, and that's eventually what happened. I mean, they got in trouble for it, but, you know, after World War II, when it was clear that using oil in war machines was the way to go. I mean, this is the way to win wars. The explosiveness of oil was so vital to fighting in battle that after the war, they were able to convince the government for this massive handout, which was the National Highway Defense Act. And that built, you know, crisscrossed the entire country with smooth asphalt for the cars to grow on. And by 1955, Americans had about 20 million cars. 20 years later, they had twice that number. And it's just got, you know, skyrocketed since then.
And I also understand, like, in the early days of oil extraction in this country, that it was kind of like anybody could go to a given state, like, let's say, Oklahoma or Texas, and start their own oil rig. What changed so that individuals no longer could really do that anymore?
Well, Rockefeller himself was really instrumental in cleaning up the oil industry in terms of getting all the smaller players out and consolidating his own power. So he was owning everything from the oil well to the pipeline to the trains to the gas stations, you know, so the whole chain of distribution. That was the model he created, and he forced a lot of the smaller players out of the market.
And he was the first person to ever do something like that?
Right. And at the time, you know, Americans hated him. And for sometimes they loved him, sometimes they hated him, but he was a notorious character for it. And, you know, maybe to assuage his guilt, you know, he set up the Rockefeller Foundation, which has been so influential in other sectors of our society, medicine and health and, you know, many others as well. Laundered all these oil dollars that people hated him for.
Right. I think actually if we look at a lot of the big foundations now, they had their start in massive exploitation of different industries, resources.
Yeah, oil and cars particularly, yeah.
So talk a bit, if you would, about some of the examples of, obviously this oil is under different regions of the world, which generally are divided up as countries. And I can't imagine all the countries that have the oil are real happy with these oil companies taking it out as they please. Can you give a sense for some of the history behind that? For instance, the one that comes to mind for me is in Iran, where there was an election and a nationalization of the oil companies, and then the oil companies basically put their own guy in there eventually.
Right. Starting in around 1960 when OPEC was formed. I mean, before then, oil companies, Western oil companies mostly were extracting oil from its most plentiful reservoirs around the world, whether it was Mexico or Russia or the Middle East, as well as the United States. And starting in 1960, with the formation of OPEC, they were getting thrown out of all of these countries. So one by one, the biggest oil producers in the world were kicking all of these companies out, taking over their assets and nationalizing the companies. So this was a huge, huge crisis for the Western oil industry. I mean, they could have died right then. And it's still true to this day that national oil companies own the vast majority of the planet's oil. Western oil companies own a tiny fraction of it, but they make several times more money selling and producing oil from their smaller reservoirs than the state oil companies do.
If the bulk of it is owned by these actual national entities, why don't we see that reflected in the markets?
Well, what happened, in the 1970s when there was the OPEC-induced oil shocks because of embargoes from OPEC, and that changed the United States' attitude towards where it's going to get its oil supply very radically. By 1971, the rate of production of oil from the United States had started to fall. So oil gushes out to begin with. You know, it's like any liquid under pressure, like your own body. You know, you pierce it, the blood's going to gush out for a while, and then the flow is going to start to slow until it just becomes a dribble. It doesn't mean all the blood is gone. It doesn't mean all the oil is gone. But it means that it's going to get a lot harder to get it out. So that had already happened in the United States by 1971. When the Arab oil embargo came in 1972, 1973, the U.S. wasn't prepared. You know, we weren't making enough oil to make up for the sudden stanching of the flow of oil from the Middle East. So oil companies kind of stepped into that vacuum, and they started exploring for oil in places where it's more hidden, you know, or it's much more difficult to get to, like in the North Slope of Alaska and in the North Sea in Britain. I mean, the North Sea is this shallow sea that actually is so stormy. In 1588, one of its storms had vanquished an entire invading armada. This is how stormy that sea is. It's somewhere you would never want to go to do something as complicated as looking for oil unless you were desperate. Same with the North Slope. I mean, back then, the ground was frozen to 2,000 feet permanently, you know, year-round. So these weren't very nice places to look for oil or to do this kind of business. But that's indeed what they did, and they had the protective wing of British and American officials who didn't want to be beholden to these strange foreigners who could suddenly, you know, at a whim, decide not to give us their oil anymore.
What's your sense of how much of that was really driven by, let's say, elected administrations versus oil companies influencing administrations towards that end?
Well, I think it was a mix. I mean, you see, when the North Slope oil fields were found, Prudhoe Bay is the biggest one, when that was found in 1969, there was no technology known to get it out of that kind of harsh climate. You know, nobody knew how to get it out. They knew there was 10 billion barrels of oil there, but how the hell they were going to get it, nobody knew. As well, environmentalists objected strenuously to the building of this gigantic pipeline. The Trans-Alaskan pipeline was a huge outrage. I mean, people were just heartbroken over it. And environmentalists and local people actually had succeeded in getting a court injunction against the building of the pipeline. So it looked like this whole thing was just going to be bust. They didn't know how to get the oil out. There's no way to get the pipeline done because there's this court injunction. So the Prudhoe Bay and Alaskan oil was going to just never be developed, it looked like. Then comes the oil shocks. And suddenly, all the floodgates are open. The Congress overruled the court injunction, and the pipeline was built. There was huge subsidies given to the oil industries to start developing all this technology to start producing oil from Prudhoe Bay, and that's what they did.
And we're seeing similar pressures now with drilling again in Alaska, that supposedly we're so short of oil that keeps coming up with the current Bush administration, that well, maybe we should go in there and take that out, even though my understanding is there really isn't very much there to extract.
Well, the estimates on what's there vary so widely, I think, because there hasn't been enough. You know, until they really start drilling and until they start producing the oil, they don't really know how much they're going to be able to get out, because it depends on the price of oil, how much money they're willing to sink in to actually getting the oil out of the ground. So, yeah, you're right. In the end, it's not going to make a big difference in terms of the global supply of oil. And the thing about oil, it's like, finding oil is like picking up pieces of shattered glass. You know, you break a window pane or something, you pick up the big pieces first, and then you sweep up the shards. And it's the same thing with finding oil. So all the good stuff has been found, like, probably prior to 1960, most of it even prior to 1930 or 1940. Since 1970, at least, the rate of discovery has gone down. So every 4 barrels of oil that we consume, we find 1 new barrel of oil. So it's just not really feasible to think that there's going to be some gigantic oil field anywhere in the world that we haven't found already, save perhaps in Iraq.
Alternative press seems to be covering a lot that we're kind of at the peak of oil extraction, and from here on out, we've basically gone through about half of what we got. Talk about that, if you would. Do you agree with that, and what do you foresee in the future, if that is true?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are either at or near the peak in worldwide oil production, and we can see what's happening already. You know, we have oil wars. We see oil companies starting to really scrape the bottom of the barrel. You know, they're developing tar sands in Canada, which is this kind of petroleum sludge that they have to use 6 times more water to get the oil out than the oil they get from it. It costs $10 a barrel to produce oil compared to like $2 a barrel or $1 a barrel in Iraq or Saudi Arabia. So, you know, and this stuff is very polluting, and it's not really oil. They actually have to use petroleum products to turn this stuff into oil. So you see this kind of desperate search for scraping the bottom of the barrel to keep this oil bonanza going. And we see this renewed interest in oil companies in going to the most impoverished, corrupted, conflict-ridden places on Earth. These are places that they rightly have wanted to stay out of for a long time, and now they're starting to go into there. And I think the consequences for human rights and the environment are fairly predictable. I mean, if we look at, you know, what's been happening in the past.
Name some of those places that they're going into that they wouldn't have in the past.
Well, the big El Dorado today is West Africa. I mean, not just Nigeria, but all along there, Equatorial Guinea, and offshore Angola, offshore a lot of the offshore areas out there in the Gulf of Guinea. That's sort of where a lot of oil industry interest is. So they're all trying to get into there. They're trying to build this new pipeline from Chad to Cameroon. And it's unlikely that they're going to find huge oil fields. I mean, they're not going to find enough to really sate global demand for oil for any appreciable amount of time. But you have to remember that even if they find, say, 500 million barrels of oil, which is enough to last global demand for about a week, you know, that at even $20 a barrel, that's a $10 billion asset. So that's a huge amount of money. So it's worthwhile to develop these smaller oil fields, even if it doesn't really make a big difference in terms of the global oil supply. So West Africa is one place. Yeah, there are big places, deep waters in Gulf of Mexico, as well as up in Siberia.
Do you see evidence that in these countries that they're doing the drilling in, that they are manipulating the governments there to allow them to do that? Because I can't imagine a lot of those situations that the populace is overly happy about having these companies come in.
Well, I think it's a mixed bag. I mean, I think that's the tragedy of it, is that some people on the ground are actually really are excited, because these are people who are living without electricity, without clean water, without running water, without sewage systems. You know, all of these things that we kind of take for granted, they don't have. And they see these big oil companies, these wealthy companies coming in, and their hopes are really palpable that this is going to mean their savior. They're going to actually climb out of poverty because of this. But in fact, you know, the history shows us that that's generally not what happens. You know, actually, in many of the oil producing countries today, especially ones that started with in a more of a developing country phase, like with smaller infrastructures and things, the national income has plummeted. People's standard of living has gone down in countries like Saudi Arabia and Iraq and Iran and Venezuela, in Nigeria, certainly. You know, all these places where there's so much oil, I mean, there's so much natural wealth, these things that everyone wants is under their ground, yet they are not prosperous. They're, in fact, impoverished by it, and their governments are more corrupt, and there's more conflict as well. So, you know, except in cases where the population is very, very small, like in UAE or Brunei, finding oil underground has not been a boon. It's been a curse.
Well, and that seems to be true of this country as well, where we have the citizens of this country just don't seem to make the connection on a lot of those things, you know. The country's literally in Iraq, a lot of people say, for oil.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. When you think about what our economy is based on, every economic transaction that happens in this country has some kind of embedded oil cost to it. You know, I mean, what is an economic transaction? It means we're digging something out of the ground, we're digging up resources, we're processing it in some way, we're packaging it in plastics which are made from oil, we're putting them on diesel-burning trucks which run on asphalt which is made from oil, and then we put them in the mall. The malls are made of plastic, they're made of concrete. Concrete uses tons and tons of oil, it's very oil-intense material to create. And then we drive our SUVs over there. I mean, the whole thing relies on oil. I mean, even Jim Kunstler talks about the 3,000-mile Caesar salad, which is exactly the right way to look at the way our industrial agricultural system works. I mean, the way we feed ourselves is, you know, even if something's grown across the street from us, if we want to buy at the local store, and even if we walk there, that piece of food has traveled, it's been packaged, it's been processed, it's been put on a truck, it's gone to some central warehouse, and then it's come back to the store. So there's no way around it. We always incur these oil costs, and we don't see it every day. Of course, you know, it's all very hidden to us. So given that the whole economy depends on burning oil, you know, when we talk about economic growth, what does that mean? That means burning more oil. So it's not a coincidence that people who are in charge of the oil industry are also in charge of the government, which is the steward of the economy. You know, so to me, it's not really a conspiracy per se. It's not, you know, some hidden agenda they have. You know, it's just the reality of how our society functions. It functions on fossil fuels.
And yet again, you look at the citizens, and when people make the leap that we're going to, let's say, a place like Iraq to fight for the oil, they're like, oh, that's absurd. It's for other reasons. It must be. But I think that shows that we've obviously pumped so much oil into our environment that's a toxin that we've killed those brain cells that recognize that anymore.
That's right. Yes, that's a good way to look at it. I mean, I think the argument that people reject is that we went there just to grab their oil because we want ExxonMobil to take it out so we can make lots of money for ExxonMobil. You know, I don't think it's as crass or simple as that. I mean, it's more about oil, especially good oil, like the kind that's in Iraq, which is easy to get to. It's going to be what they call light and sweet, which is easier to refine into the high-value products that we all like gasoline. You know, so it's very lucrative oil, you know. I mean, there's oil in lots of other places in the world that you could get out, but you'd have to spend a lot more money getting it, and then you have to spend a lot more money building a special refinery to make it into a high-value product. So in Iraq, this is good oil, same within Saudi Arabia. And there's less and less of that available in the world. I mean, a lot of the good, light, sweet oil is gone. You know, we've used it all up. That doesn't mean we're running out of oil. We still have a lot of oil under the ground, but it's less. The quality is less. So the fact that the U.S. wants to project its hegemony abroad in this place that is one of the last resting spots for this hugely lucrative and very valuable resource that everyone's going to want. You know, it's not just because they want to feed it to Americans' SUVs. You know, that China's going to want that oil. India's going to want that oil. Russia's going to, you know, well, Russia won't need it as much, but, you know, everyone's going to want that oil. So it gives us a lot of geopolitical power to be in charge of it.
Oil's like the light and sweet oil that we're pursuing and extracting in the Middle East. Can you get a lot more of the other products besides gasoline off of oil of that quality versus, let's say, the oil that they're extracting out of Canada that has sand in it?
Yes, that's exactly right. Refineries are kind of specific. Like, if it's very heavy oil, there's only some refineries that can actually process it. They only have the machinery to process it. They don't have the infrastructure to process, you know, the really bad stuff. But most refineries can always use the light, sweet stuff, and they can turn it into lots of different things. I mean, of course, the main thing everybody wants in terms of making money will be gasoline. That's the really high-value product. So if you have some other kind of oil, you know, the salt, you know, high-sulfur oil, like the kind that's in the Caspian Sea, for instance, which is very sulfurous oil, you need special refineries built to use that oil. And then there's also other byproducts that come up with that oil. Like in the Caspian, there's a big problem with hydrogen sulfide, which is, you know, sour gas is what it's called, and it's deadly. Oil workers, when they go on rigs where there might be hydrogen sulfide around, they wear these, you know, protective gas masks, and they have even a little crack. It can get into your eardrum and stuff, and you can die from that. I mean, it's like incredibly toxic stuff. So there's all these problems with the less valuable, the cruder kinds of oils, you know, the darker ones, the ones that are more sulfurous. So the light ones are just easier to use overall. So you can put it anywhere. Anyone can turn it into whatever you want. So it gives you a lot more freedom in terms of you know, selling it on the market, so you can make more money off it too, and it's easier to get out of the ground.
While you were researching your book, what things did you run across that really made you go, wow, I didn't expect that, or, you know, that was the last thing I expected to come across?
That's an interesting question. I mean, the whole story was sort of like, wow, I didn't realize this. I mean, I was your typical mindless consumer of energy. You know, before I started writing this book, I never thought about energy. I never thought about, you know, I would buy a new appliance at the drop of a hat if I could afford it and if I had room on my counter. You know, I didn't think about the amount of energy that was required to get that stuff out of the ground, the raw materials, to process it, to refine it, to package it, to put it into the shape that I need it, let alone the amount of energy I need to run it, the amount of energy that's lost when I dispose of it. You know, the whole energy cycle is not something I ever thought about. Today, of course, I think about it too much, you know, but back then I didn't. So the whole story was really a big wow for me, very enlightening. And it's stuff that we need to know, you know, as kids. This isn't rocket science, you know. These are things that we should be learning as children in the schools or, you know, in our homes. You know, kids can understand, you know, the basic laws of thermodynamics. They can learn how energy moves through systems, how we use energy and how we capture energy, how we store it, you know, all these different things. These are basic things about life and about our species that we need to know. I mean, biologists study this in terms of, you know, animals and their ecosystems. You know, how do they capture energy out of the system, and how do they store it in their tissues? How do they use it to grow? How do they expend it in order to get more energy to continue growing, to continue reproducing? You know, this is a biological concept that applies to us as well. We're organic beings too, you know. And the lack of energy literacy in this country is, I think, really shocking. You know, I mean, it really surprised me when I started thinking about it, realizing how ignorant I was myself, but that we don't have any way of passing this information on. I mean, there's no energy and education in our school system, and adults don't know enough about it to tell their kids either. So we have all this snake oil sold to us, like hydrogen fuel cells, and, you know, we're going to live in this world of no carbon, and we all can keep our SUVs, and we all can keep our microwave ovens and all the rest of it. It's just all going to be in hydrogen, and whoopee, like, we don't have to worry anymore because we just have to wait for all these new products to come online, right? You know, it's very a nice idea, makes you feel nice and calm, and like you don't have to worry about anything. I mean, an eighth grader should be able to tell you that hydrogen is not an energy source, not on planet Earth anyway. You know, on planet Earth, hydrogen does not exist alone. You know, it is always in water or in hydrocarbons or other compounds, and you need to expend energy in order to get the hydrogen out, and then you release the energy again, and in fact, usually use up more energy trying to extract the hydrogen than you ultimately get out of it. You know, it's an energy sink. Kids can understand that, I think. You know, it's like, send me $10, I'll send you a dollar back. That's what hydrogen can be, you know, that's what an energy sink is. And we should know that from the very beginning, but instead we have government officials saying, soon we're going to be running our cars on water, you know, don't worry anybody. Gasoline, water, oh yeah, plentiful, you know, there's nothing to worry about. We should be able to know right off the bat that that's not going to wash, you know, that's not going to work. But we accept it and we go about our business and it's like, okay, we don't have to worry about that anymore.
So are you doing things differently now that you have the knowledge that you've gained from writing this book?
I wish I could do things more differently. I mean, I think the issue is the way our societies are set up. They're set up to emphasize mobility. Mobility and convenience. These are like our core values as a society. And that has to change. We can't think in those terms anymore. We have to think in terms of localism. And even if it's harder to make your own lunch or, you know, just little things, we have to think about it. But it's a big shift. It's not like, you know, people sometimes talk about, well, we tamed the tobacco companies, we can tame the oil companies. But I think it's really very different. I mean, I quit smoking. You know, I didn't have to move my house and get rid of all my appliances and put my kids in a different school and have a different job in order to quit smoking. I just quit smoking. I mean, it was hard, but it wasn't that hard. If I had to quit fossil fuels, I'd have to live a completely different life. We all would. And I've seen that life. You know, I've seen that life because, you know, my family's in India and I've traveled a lot in India. I've seen people living with very little fossil fuels. I mean, if any at all. You know, they walk. They use their own power. They burn wood, of course. They get small amounts of fossil fuels, and it's precious, absolutely precious. I mean, even the middle classes in Indian cities today, you know, they know what resources they're using. They know how much water they're using. They know how much electricity they're using. I mean, every kilowatt is precious. You know, and that's how it needs to be for us, too, once we gain this literacy about the resources that we use so unthinkingly. You know, I mean, we use electricity and all the other energy resources as if we're breathing air. I mean, we just don't think about it. So we need to change all of that. I mean, for me, you know, I don't drive my car anymore, really. I ride my bike, and we got rid of all of our appliances, but it doesn't make a difference. I mean, whatever I do isn't going to make a big difference alone. I mean, we need to change something much bigger than just a couple people.
Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
Thanks, Mike.
We have just been talking with Sonia Shaw. She is author of the book Crude, The Story of Oil.